From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, World Cup fever is about to grip the globe, but with a U.S. squad out, does America care? Then Pixar storyboard artist Domi Shee says a family relationship inspired her directing debut, the animated short Bao.
I wanted to learn more about why my mom was always so overprotective of me growing up. Like, I was always so frustrated. Like, oh, like, I just want to be free. Just let me be free, woman.
And streaming has all but replaced the video store. But what else have we lost in the process? All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's Grownish, produced by ABC Signature Studios, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Comedy Series, lead actress Yara Shahidi, and contemporary costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
And National Geographic's One Strange Rock, executive produced by Darren Aronofsky and Newtopia and hosted by Will Smith, the Emmy-eligible series takes viewers on a trip around the world. NatGeoTV.com/FYC.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The World Cup, the international soccer tournament that happens every 4 years, kicks off tomorrow in Russia. And here's something that you won't hear.
Howard gratefully claims it. Distribution, brilliant. Landon Donovan, there are things on here for the USA. Can they do it here? Cross, and Dempsey's denied again. And Donovan has scored. Oh, can you believe this? Go, go, USA!
That was Landon Donovan scoring a dramatic extra time goal as the United States beat Algeria in the 2010 World Cup. In this year's Cup, the American team will be watching from home as the underachieving squad failed to qualify. But just watching at home will be tricky for some people, unless you're a complete insomniac. Owing to time zone differences, some preliminary matches, like Saturday's match between France and Australia, will start at 3 a.m. Pacific time. Fox paid more than $400 million for rights to this year's and the 2022 World Cup. Fox also will cover the 2026 tournament, which this morning was awarded to a joint bid from the United States, Mexico, and Canada. Joining us now to talk more about the World Cup and Fox's coverage plans is our friend Lucas Shaw. He covers entertainment and media for Bloomberg. Let's first deal with the fact that the United States team failed to qualify. How could that affect viewership in the States?
That is expected to depress viewership 10 to 20%. While the popularity of soccer has been growing in the U.S. for many years now, and a lot of people are familiar with players and teams elsewhere because games from England and Spain and the like are broadcast in the U.S., the three or four matches that the U.S. tends to play in every tournament are always among the most watched of the tournament and then tend to bring in some casual fans who then may stick around. Let's say they see the U.S. play Germany and they all of a sudden come to like some of the players on Germany. Germany always advances really far.
Fox bought the rights before the teams were set. With the U.S. team on the sidelines, has that changed what they can sell to advertisers and whether or not the advertisers are going to get the audience that they were promised?
Well, Fox sold about 75% of the advertising for this World Cup before they found out that the U.S. wasn't going to be there. So then what they do is kind of twofold. On the one hand, they go back to the people who already bought ads and say, okay, look, we'll give you free ads somewhere else in the tournament. We'll find a way to make this up to you because that ad real estate is no longer as valuable as it was. And then it means that with some of the kind of the remaining inventory, they lower their projections for how many people are going to watch. The pricing still stays pretty high. I mean, ad business is pretty complicated and convoluted, but basically the way it works is the overall money that Fox makes will go down largely because the number of people watching goes down.
And then there's the time zone issue. How many of the matches will be broadcast live?
All of the matches will be broadcast live. That's a move that Fox has made, and it's counter to what ESPN, which previously it had done in some cases. There's a feeling that, you know, anybody who wants to watch it live should be able to watch it live, even if it's that means that they're watching it at 3 in the morning.
Another country whose team will be absent from the World Cup is China, and yet Chinese brands will make up roughly a third of the tournament's advertising spending. So why is the World Cup suddenly such a big deal in China?
popularity of soccer is growing there. And then just for advertisers, you know, the advertising marketplace around soccer is already really well established in the U.S. You have companies that tend to be the sponsors for the World Cup, for the broadcast, for different teams year in and year out. That market isn't as developed in China. And so you see a lot of local companies and local brands recognizing an opportunity to try to be the company associated with soccer in the most populous country in the world.
With broadcasts of foreign leagues available to so many American viewers, how much is nationalism still a thing when it comes to soccer? I mean, there's not a single person in my house who's English, and we watch a whole lot of Premier League soccer.
You know, I think it matters when it comes to the World Cup, just like it matters with the Olympics or with any sport where you have your home country to root for. The difference is that the biggest stars in soccer are from other countries, and the games from different leagues, to your point about the English Premier League, are now so readily available, not just TV broadcasts on NBC, Fox, ABC, ESPN, and the like, but the kind of posts from these folks on social media. You know, the most followed soccer stars in the world, and likely in the U.S., are Cristiano Ronaldo and Neymar and people who hail from other countries. The area where the kind of the nationalism still matters is really with the casual person who has less of a reason to tune in, but is going to get really excited if the U.S. makes a run in something, much like they might, a kind of a bandwagon fan from L.A. might get really excited if the Dodgers make it to the World Series.
I think people who have watched World Cup soccer before know that it's best not watch it at home. You got to get out to a bar or a club or someplace where you're among a lot of other fans, even if it's like early in the morning.
7 a.m. Bloody Marys.
7 a.m. Bloody Marys or a pint of Guinness somewhere. Are you going to be trying to do that yourself, go out and see games with crowds, or does work call?
I will be doing that. So this afternoon, I'm going to be watching Fox's first experiment with this kind of live streaming highlight recap show on Twitter in my office. But Sunday morning, when there's a Brazil match at, I think, 9 or 10 in the morning, I'm going to get together with a friend of mine who's from Brazil, probably at a bar, and have a drink.
Final question, who's your team and how far are they going to go?
I would really like to see Colombia win because I like this guy, Rodriguez. But I feel like we might see in the final a rematch of what was a really ugly semifinal last time around, which was Brazil and Germany. And I'm gonna punt on who's going to win it because I'm too casual a soccer fan.
Lucas Shaw covers media and entertainment for Bloomberg. Lucas, enjoy your World Cup. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, Pixar's first female director of an animated short brings a steam dumpling to life.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's global event series, Genius. The new season stars Antonio Banderas as Spanish painter Pablo Picasso, one of the most influential and celebrated artists of the 20th century. Antonio and Picasso both hail from the same hometown, Malaga, Spain, where the production spent several days filming, including in the same house where Picasso was born. The series is Emmy eligible in all categories. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information. Don't just consider, explore.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In many ways, being a parent is about knowing when and learning how to let go. Right now, especially, lots of parents, myself included, are getting ready to send kids off to college for the first time. So maybe that's why I was so moved by the new Pixar short, Bao. It plays before the new Incredibles 2 movie, which is out on June 15th. written and directed by Domi Shee, the first woman ever to direct a Pixar short, Bao tells a story of an older Chinese-Canadian woman who's adjusting to her newly empty nest. She gets a second chance at parenthood when one of her homemade dumplings suddenly springs to life as a doughy little baby boy. Conveniently enough, the word Bao in Mandarin means both steamed bun and precious treasure. Domi Shee is a storyboard artist at Pixar. She'd worked on Inside Out and The Good Dinosaur before she got the idea for Bao back in 2014. It's also a personal story for her. When I reached her at Pixar, she explained her inspiration.
I think I was sitting late in my office one night and I was probably really hungry. I was just brainstorming ideas for a short, and this image just popped into my head of this old Chinese mom nuzzling this baby dumpling boy to death, and I had to just draw it down. As I was drawing more and more drawings of this dumpling character and this mom character, this story kind of emerged. I've always loved classic fairy tales like The Gingerbread Man, and I wanted to do a Chinese version of that with Bao, with a little steam bun instead of a little cookie. And I always loved how fairy tales play with really light and dark elements as well, and I wanted to explore that in the short. But also I was inspired by my own life. You know, I was an only child, or I am still an only child, growing up to my two very overprotective Chinese parents. And I felt like ever since I was little, they've always treated me like that precious little dumpling, like making sure I'm safe, that I never wandered away too far. And even though I'm kind of like the dumpling in the situation, I was really interested in exploring this relationship from the parents' point of view, because I wanted to learn more about why my mom was always so overprotective of me growing up. Like, I was always so frustrated. I just want to be free. Just let me be free, woman. And I think, using this short was a really good way for me to empathize with her more, empathize with my parents. And it allowed me to kind of just to talk to them more, to talk about their experiences, but also to talk to other people about theirs as well, with their kids and having to have them leave the nest.
What was it like to show your parents the film? How'd they react?
My dad hasn't seen it yet, but my mom has. I took her to the premiere a couple days ago, actually, and she really liked it. I asked her, did you cry? And she said, oh, I was emotional on the inside. And I'm proud of you. And I was like, oh, okay. So I think she liked it, but I think she's more proud of me, because I guess for me, the short is kind of my creation and my child, and for her, I am her work, her short. So she was really emotional and happy when everyone came up to us and started congratulating us on the short.
Like a lot of Pixar shorts, you're telling your story without dialogue, and you're also trying to cover a lot of narrative and expositional ground without using words. And I think back not only to other Pixar shorts, but that amazing montage in Up that told the entire story of the marriage and life together of Ellie and Carl. And I watched it again this morning. It's just 4 minutes and 21 seconds long.
Yeah.
Did you look at that scene or think about scenes like that? And what did they teach you about how you can convey so much emotion without dialogue?
Yeah, I mean, the opening for Up, the opening for WALL-E, they're my two favorite Pixar moments, and I was definitely looking at that opening montage and Up as reference, because you're absolutely right. How were they able to tell a whole life story in just under 5 minutes? We use more than 4.5 minutes. our short is 7.5, but Pete Docter, who made Up, he was also an executive producer on Bao and a mentor figure for me and for the crew, and I would often consult with him and show him the story reels and ask for his advice on how to make things clearer, more emotional, or more economical. And he's been a really great help, just like guiding us through this process. Because for a lot of us, like, it was my first time directing. It was Becky Neiman Cobb's first time producing. And it was just great to have his eye on the short.
I want to ask you about the look of the film, where you came up with its design. Do you reference any other films? And what were the essential conversations that you had about how this film was going to appear?
Really early on, I talked with my production designer, Rona Liu, and we established like the look and the style that we wanted for the short. We always knew that we wanted it to feel really cute and round. Like, we almost wanted the whole world to feel like a round dumpling-esque world. We love the look of miniatures. Like there's these amazing miniature sets that people build and they would just take pictures of and show online that had like all of these amazing little details of a kitchen or like of a living room, but it's just like shrunk down. And there's just something super appealing that we loved about the look of miniatures. Like, the textures on clothing are a little bit bigger, you know, like details on furniture and objects are a little bit more simplified, but it all just, it still feels very like appealing and real, but there's just a stylization to it that we really loved. And so we wanted the whole world to feel really cute and round. And me and Rona are also huge fans of Studio Ghibli. My neighbors, the Yamadas, was a huge influence for us. That's a film by the director Isao Takahata. He's like the second half of Studio Ghibli. Like, the other half is Hayao Miyazaki. And Takahata's film, My Neighbors, the Yamadas, was just so great in depicting this average Japanese family in such a charming and appealing and sentimental way. The design of the characters in the movie are very stylized. They have very big, round, squishy heads and tiny limbed bodies. But the observation to life and those like little details, like those little slice of life details in the movie, are so amazing. Like, this family having dinner around the table or going to work or going to school, and the little trials and tribulations of life, like, you know, accidentally leaving your laundry drying outside when it's raining. I just loved all of those little slice of life details, and I really wanted to incorporate that into Bao as well. So it was really important for us to get all of the cooking details right in the short. And, you know, get all the details of this mom character's household, like all the tchotchkes that you see on the TV, the Chinese calendar that you see hanging in the dining room, the rice cooker in the background. We just loved just like nerding out and just filling this world with those little details.
Let me ask you this last question. Like a lot of animation studios, Pixar doesn't have a great track record of hiring women to direct films, features or shorts, and you're the first ever female director of a Pixar short. I hope you're not the last. Where do you see that going? Where do you think female filmmakers in animation are headed, and how important is it that you were given a chance to make a short?
I feel super honored and humbled to be the first and hopefully first of many female filmmakers to come at Pixar. I think it's super important. Unfortunately, it just takes time for change, but I'm so glad that we're finally seeing it at Pixar and just in the animation industry in general. And you're seeing it on the ground floor too, like in animation schools, like all over the country, like enrollment is over 50% female right now. And that's just something that's naturally happening. More and more girls are getting into animation. And so you're going to see that affect the industry sooner or later. And I think right now is kind of like my generation, like when I was in animation school, I think it was about 50-50 at that point. So now like my generation, we're kind of slowly coming into leadership roles, and hopefully you're going to see a huge shift in the industry. And yeah, it's, I think it's so important that studios support shorts like Bao, and even like Coco and Sanjay Super Team as well, just like supporting these storytellers from these diverse backgrounds with these unique points of view, because I think that's the only way that a studio can continue innovating and telling unique and creative stories, is to draw from different wells of creativity and not just drawing from the same well. And I think Pixar knows that. So I think the future is bright.
Domi Shi is the writer and director of Bao. It is the short film playing in front of Incredibles 2. Domi, congratulations, good luck, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It was awesome talking to you.
Incredibles 2 and Bao are in theaters on June 15th. Coming up, you would think that streaming services would have a lot more movies than brick-and-mortar video stores. Well, think again.
KPCC supporters include HBO presenting Game of Thrones. Summers span decades, winters can last a lifetime. In the epic season of this colossal hit, the people of Westeros fight for their seat on the Iron Throne. Winter is here, and beyond the Great Wall that protects them, a forgotten evil has returned. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
So where do you go when you want to watch a movie, but it's not available to stream on Netflix or Amazon? The fact is, there aren't a lot of options. Streaming platforms create an illusion of easy access to films galore, but that's not exactly the reality, and their algorithms for recommending movies can be pretty spotty. Most video stores have closed down, and with them, we have lost not only access to a lot more movies, but also some movie geek clerk who could find just the right film at the right time. Kate Hagen recently wrote a story for The Blacklist about what the bigger problem is with so many video stores closing for good. And when we Skyped today, she began with a moment that she realized that our collective film history was slipping away.
I got home, it was a Friday night, and I just got this very specific brainwave that I wanted to watch Fresh Horses, which is a movie from 1988 starring Molly Ringwald and Andrew McCarthy. I thought this would be a really easy movie to find. I would have been happy to pay $2 or $3 to rent it on a streaming service. It was not on any streaming services. And so I spent about 2 hours trying to find a version of this movie online and could not. And I was like, you know what I could have done? I could have gone to a video store and rented this movie if there were still video stores.
So in terms of numbers, at the peak of its success, how many titles would a blockbuster have in its stores versus what's available to stream on Netflix right now, just in terms of movies, not TV series?
Yeah, so the number I was finding for most blockbusters was between 8 and 10,000 titles, whereas something like Netflix is only carrying about 3,500 movies at any given time. And that's really crazy to think about, that even just, you know, an average blockbuster in the middle of the country carrying between 2.5 to 3 times as many movies as Netflix.
Why has Netflix and other streaming services not embraced the model of more is better? What's driving their decision to limit and reduce the number of movie titles rather than increase it?
I mean, this is something really interesting, something I was thinking a lot about, because Netflix's DVD service still has over 90,000 titles that you can rent by mail, but most folks are not utilizing that service. I think a large part to do with all of these streaming services kind of neglecting older catalog titles is when everybody started getting into the original content game. I have zero beef with streaming services making their own content. That's absolutely okay. But when that's coming at the expense of, you know, older movies, it's a problem. Like, Netflix has 100 films on the service for the first 100 years of filmmaking. That's 100 films on the service made before 1990. And that's really staggering to think about how much is being left out of the conversation.
And if you really want to get nostalgic and spend some time in a blockbuster, you not only have to buy a plane ticket, but also pack a warm jacket. Why is that?
So there are three blockbusters left. They're all in Alaska. I would honestly love to go check one out one of these days. But you know, it's interesting to me. I think something nobody thinks about with this kind of streaming boom is there are a lot of people in a lot of parts of America and beyond who do not have access to the kind of internet that allows them to stream things quickly and easily. When you live in more rural parts of the world, you know, the video store is your connection to larger film culture. And when we've taken away those access points, we've taken away access points for viewers that, for a lot of people, I mean, it was certainly this way for me, that it's one of the first ways you start to understand that film culture is much bigger and grows much larger outside of yourself, outside of your local film community.
So even if the major studios are making fewer films, independent filmmakers are still making a lot of movies, and not all of those movies get into theaters. But it feels like if the current situation is going to continue, a lot of those movies won't be available at any time in the future. Is there just some sort of obstacle that's going to prevent those smaller movies from landing on any streaming service anytime in the future?
You know, particularly films from, I would say, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Have these kind of incredible soundtracks that are absolutely essential to the film, but relicensing those tracks for disc release or for streaming becomes really expensive. And a lot of times it's just easier for the studio to do nothing with those titles rather than relicense the music to make them available. So I would imagine that's going to be part of it with what keeps certain independent films off of streaming services. I also think there's a huge issue with, you know, ostensibly you make a movie for Netflix, you make a movie for Amazon, it gets put on the service, but there's not a lot of promotion of those titles. A lot of them are very difficult to find. They're kind of hidden within the labyrinth. And I think there's a real problem that a lot of these films that are being made specifically for streaming will never get a disc release if we start limiting kind of those pathways as more and more things become streaming only. Then that's kind of limiting the viewer experience and limiting how people can continue to consume these movies for the rest of time, not just today.
Before we let you go, any last words?
I would love it if everyone could take an hour out of their summer and find a video store in their town. And when you do that, I would love it if you would tell me about it, because we are working on the Last Great Video Store map, which is meant to be a directory of every video store, not just in America, but throughout the world.
Kate Hagen is not only a fan of Molly Ringwald and Andrew McCarthy, she is director of community at The Blacklist. She's also the author of the article In Search of the Last Great Video Store. Kate, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
One final note before we leave you. Mergers and acquisitions are on the mind, it seems. Following a judge's approval late Tuesday of the AT&T Time Warner deal, comes news that Comcast, which already owns NBC Universal, has announced an all-cash offer for most of 21st Century Fox. But you're thinking, wait, isn't Disney trying to buy Fox? Well, yes, it is. But the proposed Comcast-Fox deal is valued at about $65 billion, a lot higher than Disney's $52 billion offer for the film and TV studio. At this rate, who knows what media deal will happen next? How does Amazon, Netflix, Facebook sound? That's all for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.